What happened to them?
Leave there, I believe. Can you bear with me for a minute? Okay, we left there. I took him back to school and I dropped him off. I get the car and I follow him and we end up at the 70 parking ride off of, what is that? Cook Lane.
When you say you get in the car and follow him, whose car are you driving?
His. From what I can remember from that conversation, it was about girls and stuff. And he was like, she's fucked up, man. I'm going to do it tomorrow. I'm going to kill you.
Why would you tell Jen that you were not the one who killed Hay? What significance is that?
Because I know that I would go to jail for it. So I told Jen, I'm sorry.
I mean, did you kill her?
No.
That concludes this interview.
Time now is 2:21 a.m. on Sunday, February 28th, 1998. 1999, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I've been up for a while.
Yes.
Hi, and welcome to this week's addendum. My name is Rabia Jodhri, and I'm joined with my colleagues, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller. Now, last week, we talked about Jay's Day, or at least what we thought was Jay's Day on January 13th, 1999, using his statements, testimony, and other witness statements. But what we learned was that Jay's Day wasn't actually what Jay did. It's what the detectives told Jay to say that he did. While they pointed to maps and notes, a chronology, and cell phone records, and Jay made his statement on tape. But how do we know that this story came from the detectives and not Jay? That's because Jay's statement described facts and events that couldn't have actually happened in reality. We know that because the detectives were using an inaccurate call record and inaccurate maps of the cell towers. They were using documents that were wrong, but they expected Jay to make sure his story lined up with those documents. Remember, the police had inaccurately placed a cell tower close to Kathy's house at a time when a call came in the late afternoon. And because that cell tower was there, they somehow had to work Kathy into the statement. And Jay did it, even though they later realized it was a mistake. Now, let's talk about what led the police to Jay in the first place. And when did that happen? To recall a little bit from serial, according to the official record, the detectives learned about Jay from Jen. They had gotten a non-cell records, and they saw all these calls were made to Jen. So they tracked her down, and she led them to Jay. That's the story we know. They first approached her on February 26, 1999, and then on the 27th, Jen came down to the police station with her lawyer and her mother and gave a statement to the police. The police then went and they picked up Jay later that same night, a little bit after 11 p.m., and took him down to the homicide unit for questioning. For the first 20 minutes, Jay said nothing about the crime. And then suddenly, and kind of strangely, because it's pretty early into the interview, he breaks down and he says, "All right, I come clean." It was after this interview that he led the cops to Hay's car. And it was shortly after that, just a few hours, that Anand was arrested for Hay Minley's murder. Now, in the Intercept interview that Jay gave just a few months ago, he actually was clear that it didn't happen that way. This is what he said. "Well, first of all, I wasn't openly willing to cooperate with the police. It wasn't until they made it clear that they weren't interested in my procurement of pot that I began to open up any. They had to chase me around before they could corner me to talk to me. And there came a point where I was just sick of talking to them. And they wouldn't stop interviewing me or questioning me. I wasn't fully cooperating. So if they said, 'Well, we have on phone records that you talked to Jen,' I'd say, 'Nope, I didn't talk to Jen.' Until Jen told me she talked with the cops and that it was okay if I did too. I stonewalled them that way. No, until they told me they weren't trying to prosecute me for selling weed or trying to get any of my friends in trouble." All right. So Jay knew the police were coming for him, which contradicts the official record. that Jen's statement led the police to him just a few hours after she was interviewed. But despite her presumption that anything Jay says is likely false until proven otherwise, this statement actually matches other evidence available. In fact, in Jay's first tape-recorded interview, and remember, this began at 12:30 a.m. on February 28th, he told the cops he'd known for days that the cops were coming from him.
I learned that you guys were looking for me. And
how did you learn that?
A lot of people told me, friends of mine told me that you guys were coming to question me.
Notice the cops don't try and contradict Jay or seem surprised. They're just kind of curious about how he heard they were looking for him. But, you know, according to the official story, this can't be true. The official story is that the cops talked to Jen on February 26th. She told them nothing. Then on the 27th, she came into the police department and gave her statement. That interview ended at 6 p.m., and Jay was picked up around 11 p.m. at the video store. There wasn't any time that a lot of people could have told Jay that the cops were looking for him, because there's only 3 or 4 hours in between the time the cops first learned of Jay's relevance to the murder and when they actually picked him up, right? But even though this doesn't match the official story, it does match what Jay said to The Intercept. Remember what he said about how he ended up talking to the cops? They had to chase me around before they could corner me to talk to me. And there was a point where I was just sick of talking to them. And Jay said, this was happening before the cops had talked to Jen. So, is Jay just forgetting? Did the cops actually talk to him before they talked to Jen? The answer is yes. And here's how we know this.
On March 10th, 1999, the private investigator working for Adnan's defense team went down to the adult video store where Jay worked and spoke to Jay's boss, a woman named Sis. As of March 10th, at least officially, Jay had only spoken to the cops one time, and that was on February 27th, when the cops picked Jay up at about 11:30 p.m. from the adult video store. According to Sis, though, it didn't happen that way. Here's what Sis said, according to the investigator's notes. On either February 20th, 21st, or 22nd, Jay missed work when he responded to the Baltimore City Police headquarters for an interview. Jay was questioned several times by police, at which time Sis asked Jay if they were questioning him in reference to the girl found in the park. Jay advised that that was correct. The investigator was advised that Jay missed work to speak to the police again on February 26th. He also missed work on Friday, March 5th, to speak to the police. Sis's statement seems credible. She has no reason to lie, she's being asked to describe events that occurred relatively recently, and she had documentation to back them up. But if Sis's story is true, that's a big deal. Because as of March 10th, Jay should only have talked to the cops one time, and that was on February 27th. If he was actually talking to the cops on 3 or 4 occasions, and talking to the cops on February 20th, 21st, or 22nd, then everything we've ever been told about how the cops found Jay is wrong. The official story is that the cops went to Jen, who told them about Jay, and that's how they realized that he was their star witness. But Jen didn't ever talk to the cops until February 26th, which means if Jay is talking to the cops before then, Jen was not part of the equation. So do we have any other evidence that can support what Sis is saying? Yeah, we do. We have witness statements and documentation which corroborates Sis's story to the investigator. Let's start with the first interview Sis mentions, the one on February 20th, 21st, or 22nd. There's another witness who says that Jay was talking to the cops at that time, and that's Neighbor Boy. Neighbor Boy, if you'll recall, is the person who told his neighbor Laura that he'd seen Hayes' body in the back of the trunk. Laura told her dad about this, and her dad called the cops. So the police came out, took statements from Laura, and later took a statement from Neighbor Boy himself. Neighbor Boy denied having seen the body, and that was pretty much it. It was left it there. However, in September, after the prosecution had disclosed Neighbor Boy's existence to the defense, the private investigator tracked him down and got a statement from him. Here's what it said. About a month prior to the police finding Haley's body, Jay was at my house smoking weed with two others and myself. I did not see Jay again until about 1 week after Hayes' body was found. I saw Jay in the back of a police car near Jen's house. I later spoke to Jay, and he told me that the police got his phone number off of Adnan's cell phone records. 3 very big things about this statement. First, Neighbor Boy saw Jay in a police car near Jen's house. We know where Jay was picked up and dropped off for all of his official interviews. The police recorded that. And not one of those involved a stop or a trip near Jen's house. Which means that whatever it is Neighbor Boy saw, it was not related to one of those official interviews. Second, neighbor boy saw Jay in a police car about 1 week after Hay's body was found. News that Hay's body had been found in Lincoln Park was released on February 11th, so about 1 week after that would include February 20th, 21st, and 22nd, which again matches what Sis told the investigator earlier. And the third point of interest, the biggest one of all, is that Jay told neighbor boy that the police had found him because they had gotten his phone number off of Adnan's cell phone records. Not that the police had found him because of Jin, but because his number was one of the numbers that Adnan had called on January 13th. And when was it that the police first learned that Jay's number had been called on January 13th, 1999? February 17th, about 1 week after Hay's body was found. The statement given by Sis and the statement given by neighbor boy actually match up really closely. Both are saying that about a week after Hay's body was found, Jay was talking to the cops, and according to neighbor boy, they got to Jay because of Adnan's cell phone records, which we know the police had on February 17th. If it took them a couple days to track down Jay after getting his phone number from Adnan's cell records, then Jay was talking to the cops on February 20th, 21st, 22nd, just like neighbor boy and Sis say. What this means is that if neighbor boy and Sis are right, when the police got to Jay, it wasn't through Jen, and it was much earlier than the official record shows. The last date that Sis tells the investigator that Jay had missed work to talk to the cops was March 5th. And that's also interesting because we have reason to think that Jay might have been talking to the cops at around that time. To explain why, though, we need to go back to January 27th. On that date, Jay was arrested and charged with disorderly conduct and resisting arrest. Jay was never prosecuted on those charges, however, because on March 5th, a stet was entered. A stet is kind of like a pause button on a criminal charge. It doesn't dismiss the charge, but it does suspend it, and as long as the defendant complies with any conditions that are imposed by the prosecutor in entering the stet, it will be dismissed at a later date. But if Jay missing work on March 5th is connected to the entry of the stet on that same date, then the prosecutor would have to be involved. The cops don't have the power to enter a stet on their own. So, is there any reason to think that Jay was meeting with the prosecutor on March 5th? Yeah, there is, because guess who met with the prosecutor the day before, on March 4th? If your answer is Jin, you're right. Jin didn't just give statements on February 26th and 27th and then walk away from the case. She actually had another interview on March 4th, this time in the prosecutor's office. We know that because the police file contains a single sentence referencing the interview. It says, on 4 March 1999, your investigator, along with Detective William F. Ritz, had the occasion to respond to the state's attorney's office violent crimes unit and interview Jennifer Pusateri along with her attorney. That's it. That's the only record that was made of this interview, because neither the police nor the prosecutor saw fit to record what happened. We have no idea what Jen said or what questions she was asked, but if she met with the prosecution on March 4th, it makes sense that Jay would have been brought down to the prosecutor's office the following day. So, if Jay is missing work on March 5th to talk to the police, and if the criminal charges against Jay are dismissed on March 5th by entry of a stet, that brings us to the big question. What were the prosecutor's conditions in entering the stet? And what was Jay required to do in order to ensure that those criminal charges would not be reinstated?
Now, going back to the early morning hours of February 28th, after Jay wrapped up his first on-the-record talk with cops, and shortly before they arrested Adnan as the sun came up, Jay was asked to lead the cops to Hay's car. Now, you know, one of the most frustrating things for me has been that, according to his statements and testimony, Jay's the one with all the details about the crime. He had to be involved, right? How can somebody who knows every little bit of information not actually have something to do with the crime? He knows how Hay was killed, where she was buried, what she was wearing, what position the body was in, what was missing from the car, and of course, where her car was left after the murder. But the problem now is that we know the cops had a number of opportunities to talk to Jay before his first recorded interview, and that during the interview they supplied him with all kinds of documents and details. It's not unheard of that cops, either on purpose or inadvertently, feed witnesses details about a case. Now, we heard from Jim Tranum, a former homicide detective in Serial, but he actually first appeared on This American Life in an episode called Confessions. And in that episode, he discussed how he himself put away an innocent woman after giving her details of a crime she had nothing to do with and getting her to actually confess. So let's get back to the car. Did Jay actually lead the cops to Heyman Lee's car after his first recorded interview in the wee morning hours of February 28th, 1999? And you might be surprised to hear that Susan and I actually don't agree on this. Colin is on the fence, so he's in a safe zone. But I think the answer to that question is no. I don't think he led the cops to Hayes' car. Susan has a different opinion on it, but let's hear the clip first from the second trial. This is Jay testifying under cross-examination, and then we'll talk a little bit about it.
And then you told them, oh, I can take you there. I can show you where the car is. Did you not?
Yes, ma'am.
And they took you on your word. Did they not?
Yes, ma'am.
And while you were out, you showed them someplace else, did you not?
I believe so.
I believe so. That really means a yes, doesn't it?
Objection.
Overruled, does that mean a yes?
Yes, ma'am.
You did show them someplace else, did you not?
Yes, ma'am.
In the clip, what you hear is Gutierrez first leads in talking about where the car was parked and how Jay had actually described it to the police in his interview. Then immediately afterwards, she asks him, you were out taking the cops there, but then you went somewhere else, right? And he says, right. Now, I interpret that as meaning Jay did not take the cops to Hayes' car. He took them somewhere else first, and then maybe later he took them to the car. I feel that way for a couple of reasons, and Susan's going to explain how, you know, she's approaching this. But I think, number one, it's clear because Gutierrez sets up the question like that. I mean, in the preceding few minutes, what she's talking about is the car. Secondly, and Susan actually thinks that Jay might be referring to the trunk pop locations. But anyway, the reason I don't think it's that is because Gutierrez spends a lot of time on the trunk pop locations and other places in the testimony. So I think she did that totally separately. And lastly, I'll just say that Adnan's lawyer actually does agree, because Justin, in a number of his briefs, also cited to the fact that Jay did not lead the cops to Hayes' car. Now, I know Susan doesn't agree. So Susan, what do you think?
Just to clarify, my disagreement here is not so much about the factual question of whether or not Jay led the cops to the car. It's more about what exactly Gutierrez meant and what Jay understood that question to mean. Unfortunately, due to Gutierrez's somewhat unique style of cross-examination, it's impossible to know for sure either what she meant by that question or, more importantly, what Jay understood her question to mean and therefore what he thought he was answering. Since Gutierrez didn't clarify what Jay's response meant, we're left guessing at the record, and as a result, I don't give much importance to that particular exchange in the transcripts. However, the whole question of whether or not Jay knew where the car was is something of a red herring. There's another exchange in the transcripts from shortly before the clip that Rabia played for you that I think's even more interesting.
And in fact, you had told Detective Ritz and the Gilbury that in fact, in the intervening time, from January 13th to February 28th, that you had in fact gone back to check to see if the car was there, didn't you?
No, ma'am.
You didn't tell them that?
That's not what I told them, no.
Sir, if that appears on the tape recorder, that must be some kind of mistake?
I didn't tell them I went back to check, no.
Never. And you didn't go back to check, sir? Or you...
I went back to the area, yes.
You had gone back between January 13th and February 28th to check on the car?
I'd been through the area. My intent was not to check on the car.
Oh, so you just happened to be going by and you saw the car?
Yes, ma'am.
Jay is saying that sometime in between the crime and when he first talked to the police, he saw the car again. Not because he intended to, not because he went looking for it, but because his normal routine happened to take him across the place where the car was located. Jay has also said that he could recognize Hayes' car, which means even if Jay didn't know where the car was, that's no evidence that he was involved in the crime, because Jay has said doing his normal thing, going about his normal routine, he would have come across where the car was, and if he'd done so, he could have recognized it. So maybe Jay knew where the car was, maybe he didn't. But for me, the bigger question, and the one that actually matters, is whether or not the cops knew where the car was before they talked to Jay. And don't worry, we'll be getting to that later.
In the future episodes, we're going to talk about lots of other things we haven't gotten to. We get a lot of questions on Twitter from listeners about things that we are going to talk about in the future. So I assure you, whether it comes to the autopsy reports, the crime scene, the car, we're going to get to all of that. Now let's actually answer some Twitter questions we've gotten in the last week, and I'm going to turn it over to Susan and Colin to do that.
Our next question comes from Twitter user Chimps of OK. Chimps of OK asks, wait, Jennifer never liked Hay? Did I just hear that right? Yes, that's what Jay told the cops, that Jennifer never liked Hay. Jennifer herself never says it in those words, but in her interview with the detectives, she does indicate that she didn't have an entirely favorable opinion of Hay. Here's what she said.
She was pretty nice. Like, I mean, like, if anyone else met her, they would think that, I mean, I guess they would think that she's a nice girl, intelligent, well-dressed, kind of like ditzy, maybe. But I personally thought she was a snob because she was a little stuck up. I thought she was stuck up.
According to Jen, then, she didn't really dislike Hay necessarily, but she didn't really think well of her either.
Before getting to our next question, I'd like to replay some of the audio from Jay's first recorded police interview. In this clip, Jay is describing for the detectives the color of gloves worn by Adnan when Jay responded to the come and get me call. As you listen, pay close attention to the color of glove described by Jay.
Oh, and he's walking around with gray gloves on.
Right, what gloves are they?
Winter gloves.
Cloth gloves, or?
Yeah, they're like wool with leather palms. And that spark, I'll be walking around with gloves on for it.
Now, I figure this might be a bit of a is this dress black and blue or white and gold type situation. I played this clip for a number of people, and they're all convinced that Jay used the word gray. On the other hand, some people seem to think the color was red, and in fact, that's the color used in the police transcription. Why does it matter? This takes us to our Twitter question. It's by Jeremy. His Twitter handle is @JeremyDavidPair, and he asks, Cyril is this generation's OJ trial, and we're all waiting for Undisclosed to show us that the red glove doesn't fit. How does that work into the state's case at trial? When Heyman Lee's body was found in Lincoln Park, there are a number of fibers under and around her body. One of these fibers was red. State's theory of the case at trial is this red fiber could have come from one of the red gloves described by Jay, and he could be telling the truth. Now, there are some flaws with this theory. First, besides Jay, no one remembers Adnan having red gloves. And second, the state never tested the fiber to determine whether it came from a glove. That said, it's still some evidence Jay could be telling the truth. On the other hand, if Jay initially says the gloves were gray, that leads to the very real question of how is it that Jay went from describing the gloves as gray in his first interview to describing them as red when he testifies at trial? This question comes from Bob G. His Twitter handle is @BobWood76. He asks, can the audio you are sharing be submitted as evidence during Adnan's appeal? Could they have been submitted at trial? The answer to both questions is yes, and it's actually interesting because Maryland law on this is different from the law in a lot of states. And so in many states, if you give a statement to police and that statement contradicts your testimony at trial, that prior statement can only be used to impeach the witness. In other words, it can only be used to call into question the credibility of the witness. The substance of that prior statement is not admissible to the jury. And so if you think of Jay's story as a string or a rubber band holding the state's case together, his prior statements in many jurisdictions could only be used to have sort of a death by a thousand cuts to show this string, this rubber band being presented at trial doesn't hold things together. By way of contrast, in Maryland, if a person gives a recorded statement to police, that statement is deemed non-hearsay. It's admissible not only to impeach the witness, it's also admissible substantively to provide an alternate accounting of what actually happened. And so if we think about string theory, this is sort of the notion of, in addition to this string or rubber bands that Jay is presenting at trial, his recorded police statements are other strings. And that's another way to destroy the state's case, is to show, listen, this is one accounting Jay is giving at trial. He has given 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 other accountings before trial, and those recorded accountings are alternate scenarios you can consider that bog down the state's case against Adnan.
Our next question comes from Twitter user Glowing Skin Girl, who writes, wondering if there was a lapse in time between Jen's sign-in and her recorded interview. What she's referring to is the pre-interview, which is the period of time in between when a witness first comes into the station and when the tape recorder is actually turned on. Like we discussed last week, Jay had pre-interviews before both of his tape statements. The first one was about an hour long, and the second one was 3 hours long. So, did Jen also have a pre-interview? Was there also a period of time in which she was talking to the cops off the record and potentially could have had her statements influenced by them? Yes, she did. On Saturday, February 27th, Detectives Ritz and McGillivary went to meet Jen at her attorney's house at approximately 1 p.m. 2.5 hours later, they went down to the station where the tape recorder was turned on and Jen gave a formal statement. However, we have no idea what they talked about during those 2.5 hours or what discussions resulted in them going down to record the final interview.
This question comes from Rebecca Rohan. Her Twitter handle is @RR94. She asks, episode 3 was jaw-dropping, but will any of it make a difference for Adnan? Will this help with his current case or a future appeal? This leads to the issue of what's the status of Adnan's current case. He brought a petition for post-conviction relief with the circuit court in Baltimore City based upon ineffective assistance of counsel. That court denied him relief. He's currently appealing to the Court of Special Appeals of Maryland. His hearing is in June. One school of thought is the court could remand, i.e. send the case back down to the circuit court to have Asia McLean testify. If that doesn't happen, and if Adnan is denied relief, he still could move to reopen his post-conviction review proceeding with the circuit court under Maryland Code of Criminal Procedure Section 7104. That allows for reopening a case when it's in the interest of justice. One ground would be prosecutorial misconduct. The claim here would be that Kevin Yurick, the prosecutor in Adnan's initial trials, either dissuaded Asia from testifying or misrepresented what she said when he testified at Adnan's original hearing that she only wrote the affidavit about seeing Adnan in the library until 2:40 based upon pressure from Adnan's family. The other possible ground, which is raised by what Susan has found, is police misconduct. And so another ground for reopening the hearing would be that the police, when they took Jay's statement, knew it to be false. Now, that's a pretty tough standard to meet. And the problem here is we're a bit like Gene Hackman in the classic movie, The Conversation by Francis Ford Coppola. We have the audio of what happened during that interview, but we're left sort of piecing together exactly what was going on with the paper shuffling and the tapping. I think probably the strongest thing that Susan has found is how Jay's story shifted from saying he was at a McDonald's at a certain point in time to saying he was at Kathy's apartment based upon the police getting an initial map of where a cell tower was and then getting a second map where that cell tower was shifted from a location that covered McDonald's to the area that covers Kathy's apartment. That question leads into the next question. It's by Lauren Paterney. Her Twitter handle is @LaurenPaterney. She asks, I heard the tappings right away. Wow. Are there any physical tapes to see if someone slid a note? The answer is no, because back in 1999, the Baltimore City Police Department didn't usually do two things when interviewing people like Jay. First, they usually made no attempt to record the pre-interview. That's the initial portion of the interaction between the police and the witness when they hash things out before the witness goes on record. Second, even when the witness went on record, they typically didn't do an audio-visual recording and only did an audio recording. That policy changed in 2008 when Maryland passed Section 2402 of the Maryland Code of Criminal Procedure. That section doesn't require the audiovisual recording of interviews, but what it does do is strongly encourage that recording in certain severe cases, including murder cases. Moreover, Maryland also passed Section 2404 of that code, which requires the Governor's Office of Crime Control and Prevention to make an annual report to the House Judiciary Committee. According to the most recent report, Baltimore City has 18 interrogation rooms, and two of those are capable of audiovisual recordings. Moreover, Baltimore City requires audiovisual recording of both the pre-interview and the interview and homicide investigations. So where does that place Baltimore? Where does it place Maryland? Maryland is one of 21 states that has some type of policy on audiovisual recording. And Baltimore City is one of about 850 jurisdictions across the country with some type of policy. Now, if you compare that in 2008 to 1999, that's a huge expansion in the number of jurisdictions that either encourage or require audiovisual recordings. And why? Well, the answer is the Innocence Project. Over that period in time, there have been a number of exonerations based upon DNA evidence, and the Innocence Project is also working on Adnan's case and has some interesting new findings that should be coming out soon. And so based upon that, a lot of jurisdictions looked at those results and thought, a lot of these exonerations are coming in cases where we have false statements or testimony being given by witnesses, and that makes it incumbent upon jurisdictions to do their best to record these interviews and pre-interviews to determine what's going on. Are these honest statements? Is there police coaching? Is the story consistent from the pre-interview to the actual interview?
Twitter user Penny Sibilla writes, "Some parts of recordings are detectives telling Jay his own statement, and he's just saying, yes, yes, yes." Yes, you are exactly right. Many parts of the statements involve Jay simply agreeing with statements that are basically being given by the detectives and not by Jay. Here's an example of that in action.
That was it? That's all he called you that day?
That he was going to kill her, but it wasn't. He didn't give any details. He just said,
You didn't how?
Huh?
You didn't know how he was going
no,
to kill her.
No.
But he told you that he was going to kill her.
Yes.
Because she had broken his arm.
Yes.
And that night, he contacted you again.
Yes.
And had made plans to meet with you on the 13th.
Yes.
Where he could give you his car and cell phone to assist him.
Yes.
And you'll explain that later, correct?
Yeah.
You can hear how disinterested McGillivray is in hearing what Jay has to say. When Jay tries to interrupt to give his own statement, McGillivray cuts him off and has him answer yes again to another question.
Thanks so much for your questions. Keep them coming. And again, I assure you a lot of the things you want us to address, we are going to talk about in future episodes. Between the day that Haman disappeared and the day her body was found, those 28 days is when the investigation really took shape. So we have to figure out how, from day 1 to day 28, the police really followed a trail all the way to Adnan. So next time, on next week's Undisclosed, the investigation. A very special thanks to our sound editors, Amr Naji and Ben Bruning. Thanks to Ramiro Marquez, who created our theme music, and to Baluki, who designed our logo. Dennis Robinson is our executive producer. You can find us online, on Facebook and Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @undisclosedpod. Be sure to tweet us your questions and comments using the hashtag undisclosed.
I believe that concludes this interview.